A new report finds that the Great Lakes are warming, and although that might make for better swimming, higher temperatures could have a disastrous effect on Lake Michigan's game fish, like trout and salmon, which depend on cold water. Also this hour, if you've ever wanted to see a Smithsonian-style museum exhibit but can't make it to Washington, Illinois Humanities is bringing them to quote-unquote main streets across the state. We'll tell you when they're coming to your neighborhood. But first, there are more than 55,000 homeless students in Illinois, a number that's been growing since 2016, according to the State Board of Education.
There's a lack of knowledge of the homeless students in our community. We need more people identifying them, and I think that's where agencies such as ourselves come in.
That's Sharice Larson from the Bloomington group Project Oz. Today on the 21st, as school starts again, how are schools and others trying to help these students living with homelessness? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As students return to school this month, many high schoolers are worried about passing calculus, making the football team, getting ready to take SATs. When Danny Green was in high school, making sure he could find a place to sleep was another worry he had, and obviously a big one. The State Board of Education reports that the number of homeless students has climbed over the past few years. In 2016, there were 53,733 homeless students. By this year, that number's up to more than 56,000. What's behind this number and what's being done to help students in need? We've gathered a few folks to talk about that, but we want to start with Danny Green and his story. At 16, he was kicked out of his house and found himself without a permanent residence as a sophomore in high school. He's now a college student studying computer science at Heartland Community College in Bloomington. Hi, Danny. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Danny, I wonder what you can share with us about what happened during that time. This was a couple of years ago when you were 16. How did you end up not having a place to live?
It boils down to I've had a lot of problems with my mom and my dad. Eventually I told my mom that my sexuality was that I'm gay, and she had a huge issue with that. And that was one of the major issues among a few minor issues, and eventually ended up not being at home anymore.
And I mean, at 16, I can't imagine how tough that would be, Danny. Who did you first reach out to for help when you were in that situation?
One of my guidance counselors at school helped me out with a lot of things. I had people in a different church than the one my mom went to was going to, and they were able to help me out. And I just kind of worked through it and had a unique experience. But one of the major key things for me graduating high school was my guidance counselor helping me figure out things out.
And was that a situation, Danny, did your guidance counselor know about the problems that you were having before? Was it something where it was hard to share with your guidance counselor what you were going through?
It was, but I always trusted my guidance counselor. She is one of the best people that I've ever talked to, and she is one amazing person that I knew I could trust. And so start of my freshman year in high school, I told her this is what's going on at home, and she helped me work through some things before my sophomore year.
And was that initial time when you were a sophomore, was that the only time you found yourself without a place to stay, or did that happen a couple times throughout high school?
That happened a couple times throughout high school. It happened my junior year as well as my senior year.
And what high school were you going to at the time, Danny?
Normal West High School in Normal, Illinois.
Danny, do you think people knew what was going on with you at the time, like other students, other teachers, or was it something you didn't really want to share with anyone?
It's not something I wanted to share with some people and other people. I felt that I could trust them. I knew that the teachers had been sent an email saying this is what's going on. If you can give Danny a break, that would be amazing. So I was able to lax on my homework a little bit for a couple weeks. And I knew that some of the students had found out, and then word got around the school, and I kind of felt like, that, you know, some people were more closer to me, and other people just, you know, didn't know how to react, and other people just didn't even want to kind of associate with me after that.
I'm sure when you look back on that time now, what do you remember of it? I wonder what you remember of how you felt during that time.
One of the things that I felt was that I didn't have a place of my own. I couldn't find a place just to be myself and relax. And that was probably the hardest part, because not being able to be yourself is detrimental to your mental health.
And how do you feel now?
I'm a lot better. I have my own apartment, and so I'm able to go home and relax and sleep, do my homework, and just, you know, have the comfort that I know that I have a place to go when I'm done with my job for the day, or I'm done at school for the day. I can go home and pretty much do whatever I can do at my apartment.
Danny, I know that part of this is in part because of the organization Project Oz. Can you tell us a little bit about how you first found out about them?
Yeah. So when I was in high school, there was this lady, Miss Jessica, who she was working with this organization called Project Oz. And how I got to meet her was I had a meltdown in one of my classes, and the teacher told me that I had to go see Miss Jessica before I could return to class. And so I did, and I loved Miss Jessica. She was amazing. And she ended up referring me to the Project Oz program, to where I was able to get help with things. And Angela, who was my initial contact with the program, set me up for future success in the program, to where I was able to enter into what they called the Transitional Living Program. And that is what the program I am in now.
We've been hearing Danny Green's story. He is now he's a college student studying computer science at Heartland Community College in Bloomington. We do have some people from Project Oz with us. Sharice Larson is on the line. She's the supervisor of the Homeless Youth Program at Project Oz, which is a nonprofit based in Bloomington. Sharice, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
We've also got Ted Peso with us, who's on the line. He's the manager of advocacy and community affairs at the Knight Ministry in Chicago. Hi, Ted.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Sharice, as we're hearing Danny share his story, I wonder if you can give us a sense of, in a community like Bloomington Normal, how many young people are in the situation he was in a couple of years ago?
Right, yeah. So, you know, it's hard to gauge specific numbers only because a lot of those students that are in the schools kind of fly under the radar. Kind of like he said, he talked about how he didn't really want a lot of people to know, and he thankfully reached out to his guidance counselor, to his teachers, and they were the ones who were really able to pinpoint that. But to give you an idea of how many young people we helped just last year alone, we had probably 130 that were just homeless, kind of street-based, couch surfing alone, and a lot of those were under the age of 18. And so many reasons as to why they were homeless. It was, you know, family issues at home, you know, gender identity, sexual orientation, coming out to their parents and their parents not agreeing. It could be trying to flee from a harmful situation at home. And so, you know, while it looks like they're choosing to leave home, they're choosing to leave home because it's a safety issue.
And when we think about Ted, I wonder if you could help us a little bit further with some definitions that Sharice started for us. When we're saying youth homelessness, what does that mean exactly? And how would this differ from an adult who is also homeless?
Yeah, so when we say youth or young adult homelessness, we mean young people generally in the age of about 14 to 24 years old. And so while some of the situations that young people present with are very similar to situations that an adult would present with that could result in homelessness, we see the response being a little bit different. So generally we know that young people become homeless because of a variety of reasons. Some of the reasons that are specific to young people include you know, aging out of foster care systems and experiencing homelessness, or leaving the juvenile justice system, and being homeless. We see young people who become homeless as a result of young teen pregnancy, or young people coming out of the closet, so coming out and getting kicked out. And then I think the important thing to note is that the response needs to be age appropriate. So it needs to consider a young person's developmental stage, right? So education may be a really important thing for a young person, just like it is for any other young person. And so that needs to be considered when providing services to a young adult or youth.
And when we think about services as well, Sharice, I imagine we're also talking about different accommodations rather than, for example, when we think about adults and the possibility of going to a homeless shelter. Is that even possible for someone who's under age 18?
No, it's not. You know, and it depends on the area, but here in Bloomington Normal, we don't have youth shelters at all. And even, you know, even 18-year-olds, 18, 19, 20, kind of the older homeless youth, it's not best practice to have them in adult-based shelters because a lot of these youth have been traumatized by older adults. A lot of them have encountered sexual exploitation, and putting them into an adult shelter just causes them to be at a higher risk of re-exploitation. And so what we do here locally is we rely heavily on a host home network who are just licensed foster care homes who are contracted through our agency, and they provide temporary shelter for our young people under 18.
Mm. Danny, when you were in this situation, I remember you talked about sort of this time that before you found help at Project Oz, and you were mentioning a meltdown that you had in one of your classes. What kind of obstacles do you think you had to deal with that while you were in the situation that maybe a traditional high schooler might not have to have thought about?
Well, there was unique situations with me, and but one of the things that I saw in a couple of my friends that also ended up being homeless was the fact that we didn't have an adult or a parental figure that we could trust and we knew that we could rely on, because there are things that we do need in high school for them to do for us. For example, we need them to go to registration with us to register for school. I needed to have my parental figure sign some documents for health class or for an extracurricular activity or a field trip. And there were a couple of field trips that I couldn't go on because I couldn't get a parental figure to sign for me.
Sharice, when we think about the kind of services that Project Oz provides for young people, what kind of things do you all do in addition to, as you said, the immediate need, which is shelter?
So just like Danny spoke on, he was talking about some of the resources and activities that he needed for school. And what we do as an agency is we connect with the school district's McKinney-Vento liaison. So McKinney-Vento basically says that any student who's considered homeless should be treated equally as any other student who does have a home. And so we connect the young person to that McKinney-Vento liaison, who is normally a social worker in the school, and make sure that they're made aware of any homeless student that we come across. And that way, then they can get transportation. If they're not in their home-based district, if they're out of district, but they still want to go to their school of origin, they'll arrange transportation, they'll arrange school supplies, they'll arrange food, meal services, all of that, because all of that should never be a barrier to any young person who's trying to fulfill their education. And we don't want young people to worry about that when they're already concerned about where they're going to sleep at night. So I think that's one of our main connections. Outside of that, a lot of it is basic case management and counseling, trying to connect them with a positive, caring adult in their life, who may be a teacher, who may be someone from a local church, who may be a distant relative that they just haven't reconnected with. And so those are a lot of the things that we do. And then, like you said, shelter and just basic needs. So if someone needs socks or a t-shirt or basic hygiene items because they're couch surfing and bouncing from place to place, we don't ever want that to be a barrier. So we try and provide anything that we can for them.
Ted, Danny mentioned the schools and the role the schools played with this. I understand you work, the Knight Ministry works directly with Chicago Public Schools with some of your clients. What role do you think schools play in providing assistance to students who are homeless?
Schools play a huge role in providing assistance to students who are homeless. Like Danny said, they can provide that supportive relationship, and we know that supportive relationships are the key in helping young people kind of find independence. We know that if a young person can identify supportive relationships in their life, they're less likely to have repeated instances of homelessness as a young adult or an adult. The Knight Ministry actually partners really closely with Chicago Public Schools, where this is a huge issue. Last year, 18,000 students experienced homelessness in Chicago Public Schools. It's roughly about 5% of enrolled students. And it's such an issue that one school, North Lawndale College Prep High School on the west side, partnered with the Knight Ministry to open up a housing program for their homeless students. We opened that program last year. So we can provide support to students who are experiencing homelessness and their family, and work to study the family situation, provide support to the student while they're in school so that the issues in the family won't result in any permanent fracture and will help the young person attain their educational goals.
Ted, is it usually the school's responsibility? Do schools have a responsibility to identify these students?
Well, so in Chicago, there's actually a homeless liaison in every public school, and their role is to identify the students as they can, right? But the issue is that it's not a dedicated position, so it's often something that's on top of other duties that they're doing. So it might be the school clerk or a school coach or a teacher who's the homeless liaison in addition to the other roles that they're doing in the school.
You there for a second, Ted, because we do need to take a short break here, but we can pick up your thought on the other side of this. And I'm interested, Sharis, to hear from you what this looks like in Bloomington outside of Chicago. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st as we're talking about this issue of homelessness among high school students.
Support for The 21st comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting the experimental films of Renee Baker on Saturday, September 22nd at 2 p.m. at the Pennsylvania Avenue Residence Hall. Baker will present her films and discuss the creative process in producing these works. More at cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the problem of homeless students in Illinois' K-12 schools. According to the State Board of Education, we're talking about more than 56,000 students across our state. My guests are Danny Green, who's a Project Oz alum. He's been sharing his story with us. He's now studying computer technology at Heartland Community College. Sharis Larson is also with us from Project Oz. And Ted Peso's on the line from Chicago, where he's the manager of advocacy and community affairs at the Knight Ministry. Ted, if you can just finish that thought. We were talking about the role of schools in identifying these young people. And you were saying that oftentimes a homeless liaison, that's one of the many titles that they might have.
Yeah, and so I think for many homeless young people, they react by not wanting to disclose their homelessness, right? They might feel ashamed of it, or they might be afraid that if they disclose it, something bad is going to happen to them or their family. So I think what schools can do is they can create an environment that breaks down stigma and provides a safe space for young people to disclose that information. They could also train their staff about how to identify whether a young person's homeless or not. And I think the community has a role, too, in supporting the liaisons in the schools and kind of understanding, you know, if they see something with their children's friends that is concerning, they could bring that to the school's attention as well.
Sharis, how does this work in Bloomington Normal? Are there homeless liaisons in every school?
There are, yes. And I would just echo what Ted said, that even though there are homeless liaisons, they do wear many different hats. So there's social workers, there's school counselors, and they're just doing a variety of things. So like Ted mentioned, it's hard to always capture everyone with every concern. But thankfully, here in Bloomington Normal, which is a little different in Chicago Public Schools, Project Oz specifically has school-based outreach workers in each high school. So when we can connect with a homeless liaison that's in the schools, we can connect with them because we are there currently in the schools all day. And so it makes it a little easier on us. We can kind of double team. And if there's someone that we can focus on that maybe the homeless liaison didn't necessarily get information on, we've already got that covered and vice versa. And so we are very fortunate to have those wraparound services here. But again, that's much easier here in a smaller community than it is in Chicago Public Schools.
And I wanted to ask you about that, Sharice. On the one hand, as you're saying, this is easier in terms of it being a smaller community and you may be having more of a handle on the problem. Are there other differences to a larger city like Chicago, which I imagine has a lot more social service agencies and resources maybe dedicated to this issue?
Correct, yes. So they're going to have a much larger service area. They're going to be able to, they have more services to connect young people to, and we aren't going to have that. We are the only runaway and homeless youth provider here in McLean County, and so we've got kind of the entire problem falling under our caseworkers, and we're equipped to handle it, but it's definitely a challenge. And so the services that are available here in Bloomington Normal are far less. And like I mentioned, there are no youth shelters. So we have to work with a network of host homes who are amazing and who have done phenomenal work for us. But in terms of other services, it is hard to connect the young people with services in the community.
Danny, I wonder if we could end with you and your thoughts on this. It's really remarkable to me that after everything that you went through, that you're now at Heartland Community College, you have, as you said, you have your own apartment, you're studying computer science. As you have the hindsight of looking back on what you went through, what do you want people to know about your experience?
The first thing is that there is always people out there to help you. You just got to look and ask. That was a key thing in my success, was the fact that I had somebody saying, hey, this is happening. You can go talk to this person. Another key thing would be always keep your head up. Even things are looking as bad as they are. If you keep your head up, you eventually, you can get through it and with help from others, and you'll be able to succeed in life a lot better than if you always look with your head down.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. That's Danny Green. I want to thank Sharice Larson, who's a program supervisor with Project Oz, and Ted Peso with the Knight Ministry in Chicago. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
If you've ever been swimming in one of the Great Lakes here in the Midwest, you know they all have one thing in common, being icy cold. Even on the warmest summer day in Chicago, the water remains, maybe we could call it refreshing, I call it scary. But a new report from researchers at Purdue University finds the Great Lakes are actually warming. And although that might make for better swimming, higher temperatures could have a disastrous effect on Lake Michigan's game fish like trout and salmon, which depend on cold water. This could also affect smaller inland lakes with fragile ecosystems. To learn more about this report, I'm joined on the line now by Paris Collingsworth. He's a research professor in the Department of Forestry and Natural Resources at Purdue University. He's also the Great Lakes Ecosystem Specialist for the Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant. Paris, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also on the line with us from Chicago in the Shedd Aquarium is Karen Murchie, a research biologist at the Shedd. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Paris, when we're thinking about this report that you and your colleagues recently released, the idea is that the lake is maybe warming, is it by 1 degree? And that's what we're looking at, warming temperatures. How much of a warming is that? For people, I think for people who are not in your industry, saying like a lake is warming by 1 degree is hard for us to understand how significant that is.
Right. So we have observations from Lake Michigan that have shown that the surface waters in the lake have been warming at about 1 degree Fahrenheit per decade. But this ends up translating into, you know, by mid-century, we're talking about water temperatures that are forecasted to increase by, you know, 5 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. And you're right, you know, from a human perspective, that really doesn't sound like a lot of warming. But rising temperatures can have big effects on the ecosystems because of how they interact with certain components of the ecosystem. For example, increases in water temperatures could make Lake Michigan much more susceptible to invasion by invasive species. And that's just one of the things that we talk about in our impact assessment.
And when we're thinking particularly about colder water fish, like Lake Michigan's game fish, as we're thinking about, how would that affect the ecosystem?
Right. So many of the fish that people care about in Lake Michigan, you know, things like salmonids, like the Chinook salmon, the coho salmon, and the lake trout, they prefer, you know, colder water. So, you know, say approximately, you know, 50 degrees Fahrenheit. What will happen in this warmer and changing climate, it's going to push these fish further offshore. They're going to be able to find water that's at their preferred temperature, but they're going to have to go further offshore to do it. And what that can do is that can have pretty dramatic impacts on the fisheries of the lake. For example, if you're having to go further offshore, that's going to make your fishing trips much more expensive to get out further out into the lake. It could also even have large-scale effects where it's making different ports less productive from a fisheries perspective. So, say, for example, along the southern shoreline of Lake Michigan, it could be that charter fishermen are finding that they're having to go so far offshore that it would make more sense economically for them to move their boats out of the southern harbors and move them, you know, say, to Wisconsin, where they have deeper waters that are closer to the shoreline.
Mm. Karen, I was actually surprised to find out that we have salmon in Lake Michigan. What other, Paris mentioned some of them, but what other types of big game fish do we have in our lakes? And are there a lot of them?
Oh, there's a lot of different fish that people like to catch in the Great Lakes, whether it's a yellow perch or smallmouth bass as well. Pumpkin seeds are also very common too. There's a lot of the panfish that people like to fish for beyond the trout and the salmon as well. And there is just that diversity there. There's, again, sort of whether you're angling from shore versus angling by boat, you'll find different species and people fish for them based on those requirements as well and just what they like to catch.
And Karen, apart from the fishing aspect of it, how will the warmer water actually affect these fish that like colder temperatures?
Well, I think just like really humans like different temperature ranges and in our houses too, we all have our preferences for what we like. The variety of different fish species have their temperature tolerances as well. And I realize that there is a lot of focus on the game species, but there's a lot of different species that are playing a supporting role to game fish as well. And I like to think it's worth mentioning all the different species that are in the lake that we should consider when talking about changing climate, because if any of the smaller bodied fish that are important as forage for game species, they're responding to changes in climate too. And they their populations can change also that could end up having an effect. So I think that's just an important aspect for your listeners to be aware of as well,
mm-hmm.
that it's not just the game species that can be affected by the change in climate.
Right. To your point, Paris, I wonder, because you all looked at this, right? You looked at food webs. I know in your research, you look at smaller species like plankton and crayfish. We've been talking about warmer climates, but also what about wetter climates? What impact does more rain have on this food web?
The more, I guess, robust predictions about climate change is that we're going to see pretty dramatic changes in the hydrology. So it's not so much just that there's going to be, you know, more water or less water. It's that we are going to see changes in the amount of water, but also in the timing of, like, when that water is delivered into the system. One thing that does come up pretty frequently in the climate models is that we're going to have much wetter springs. And so springs are a really important time for nutrient delivery into the Great Lakes. So springs are, it's a time when a lot of farmers are typically putting fertilizer on their fields. And then if we have a lot of precipitation before, you know, the crops come up and can take up those nutrients essentially get washed off into the tributaries and ultimately make their way into the lakes. And so if we have really, you know, dramatic changes in the amount of water that's coming into the spring, we could see a lot more nutrients that are coming off of the watershed coming into the lake. That can be a good thing and a bad thing. In the middle of the lake, out in the open water, we tend to suffer from a lack of nutrients out there. But unfortunately, what happens a lot in Lake Michigan is we have really strong longshore currents that tend to take the nutrients and keep them in nearshore areas. We also have an invasive species called quagga mussels that are very abundant on the bottom of Lake Michigan, and they tend to be concentrated in nearshore areas, although they are expanding out into deeper waters. And they also tend to use up a lot of these nutrients, or essentially feed off the phytoplankton that's using these nutrients before they have an opportunity to make it out into the open lake and work their way into those food webs.
And Karen, what effect does that have? So to Paris's point about, for example, this invasive mussel species, what effect does that have on smaller fish and then up the food chain?
Well, as Paris was getting at, too, depending on where you're living in the lake and the nutrient runoff and who gets what and how that might affect the, you know, whether the increased precipitation bringing in nutrients, is that going to be a positive or potentially negative effect? But everything is really tied together. So depending on where, whether it's the invasive species, how they're distributed and what nutrients they take in terms of competing with other organisms for those resources, it just sort of plays into it, a numbers game, and in terms of who's where and how many and that kind of competition. So it does get to be a little bit more complex when you're trying to figure out the exact effects that are going to happen in certain locations. It has a lot to do with where the species are distributed. That's going to be based on the different physical attributes of that location, the temperature, the oxygen, the depth, and the amount of light that gets there. So I think that's kind of feeding off of what Paris was saying.
And Paris, is this clear that this is happening because of climate change, correct?
The changes in precipitation?
And temperature?
Yes, yeah, that's certainly what the climate models are forecasting.
And so I think there are probably some people who are listening who wonder what they can do about this. Is there anything?
Well, so one thing that we focus on in our assessment is essentially the lake managers. And that's, as Karen mentioned, these climate change effects are really quite complicated, and they involve interactions with a lot of the sort of current stressors that management agencies in the Great Lakes are dealing with, things like invasive species and nutrient deliveries. And so what we suggest is that the managers, they should stay focused on these short-term threats, but we need to have more research to understand how these threats interact with warmer temperatures and the changes in hydrology that may occur.
That's Paris Collingsworth, a research professor in the Department of Forestry and Natural Resources. A Great Lakes also ecosystem specialist for the Illinois Indiana Sea Grant from Purdue University. We will have links to Paris and his colleagues' research online. I want to thank Karen Murchie for being with us as well. She's a research biologist at the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us.
listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Smithsonian Museums in Washington are an incredible repository of our history, our culture, and our art. My favorite is the amazing new African-American History and Culture Museum. Of course, it's not every day I get to D.C., and for many people, maybe they never have that chance. That's why Illinois Humanities has teamed up with the Smithsonian to bring exhibitions to you. Throughout this year, as part of Illinois' bicentennial, there's going to be traveling exhibitions produced all over the state. And the first stop is in Chester, Illinois, which is about an hour south of St. Louis on the Mississippi. We're joined now by the director of the Chester Public Library, Tammy Graw. Hi, Tammy. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Matt Meacham is also on the line with us from Illinois Humanities. Hi, Matt. Thanks for being here as well.
Hi. Great to be here.
Matt, can we start with the goal of these traveling exhibitions? It's being called Museum on Main Street. Why did you all want to partner up with the Smithsonian to bring this to people?
Well, the Museum on Main Street program has existed since 1994, and it's operated cooperatively by the Smithsonian and the state humanities councils around the country. We've been lucky enough to be involved with it from the very beginning. It offers traveling exhibitions to organizations in small communities that are designed and produced by the Smithsonian and address important topics in American culture. And so, first of all, it is an opportunity for Illinoisans in small communities and rural areas to experience, an exhibit from a world-class museum in their own backyard. But it's also an opportunity for the local host organizations, libraries, museums, historical societies, and so forth in small towns in Illinois to expand and learn some new skills. So it's really intended to be a growth opportunity for them. They produce locally focused companion exhibits that link the topic of the Smithsonian exhibit to their own local history and culture, and the Chester Library has done an outstanding job of that. So that's kind of a growth opportunity for them, and they also host public programs. So it's a chance for folks to see a Smithsonian exhibit at home, but it's also a chance for the organizations who host them to kind of take a step up in some ways.
Tammy, can you tell us about what the exhibit will be at the Chester Public Library?
Well, in addition to the Crossroads exhibit, Crossroads Change in Rural America is the title of the Smithsonian traveling exhibit. Our local companion exhibit, as Matt said, is called Change Through a Local Lens. And we have six areas that we have focused on around our community to be included in that exhibit.
And why do you think Chester is a good place to start this, as you all are the first stop of this traveling tour?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, we're here in Randolph County. We are the county where Illinois began. Our state's first capital, Kaskaskia, is located in Randolph County. And that's how we kick off our local exhibit with a feature about Kaskaskia and all the changes it has taken place in Kaskaskia over the years. Whether your listeners know or not, Kaskaskia was basically wiped out by the Mississippi River back in the late 1800s and now is west of the Mississippi. So our first state capital, you have to drive through the bottomlands of Missouri, to get to our state's first capital. So we feature that, a lot of interesting information about our state's origin. Of course, I said this is touring in conjunction with the state's bicentennial, so we had to start there. And another great reason why we are excited to have the exhibit here is because one of the co-curators of the exhibit is actually from our county as well. Dr. Deborah Reed was hired by the Smithsonian to co-curate Crossroads. So our first public program was to have the co-curator of the exhibit here at the Chester Library, which we were very excited to have her here.
And Tammy, I wonder how often, I'm not sure how big Chester is, if you could share the population size with us, but how often people have an opportunity to see exhibits like this in your town?
Well, this is the first time in our town. Our town is about 8,500, and this is the first time we've had the opportunity to host a traveling Smithsonian exhibit. So we're really thrilled to have it here.
I want to welcome another person into this conversation as well. We've been speaking with Tammy Graw from the Chester Public Library and Matt Meacham with Illinois Humanities. Bill Thomas is also with us from Atlanta, Illinois. Bill's the Atlanta Public Library with the Atlanta Public Library and a museum, and he's also the coordinator of the exhibition there. Bill, thanks for being with us, too.
Very glad to be with you, Nyla. Thank you.
And so that's actually the, I would say, for folks who are listening in the, we know people are listening all over the state. For folks who are in central Illinois, particularly if you're in Champaign-Urbana, this is the closest you will get to be able to see this Crossroads exhibit, right, Bill, in Atlanta?
That's right. Yes, we welcome any and everyone to come and join us.
And now this is not coming to you all. I should mention to our audience, we will tweet out details of the exhibit so you can see all of the different stops. We'll also have that at our website, 21stshow.org. But Bill, the Smithsonian is not coming to Atlanta until February for you guys, correct?
That's right. It will be in town February 2nd through March 16th.
And what are you all planning for your local exhibition?
Our exhibit will focus on what we think is a really important change in rural America over the past 100 years. And that's the change in sense of community as related to whether or not a town still has its high school in the small area, and what's happened over time as many of those school districts have consolidated. So what we're really looking at and interested in is the idea of, well, we think a school's location and the size of the geographic area it serves impacts the degree to which that school contributes to that place's sense of community. So we're going to be looking at what used to be the one-room school districts that surrounded our town, and then over time in the late 40s, they were consolidated into the town that was located in our community of Atlanta. And then in the early 1980s, our town actually ended up being consolidated along with seven other small rural communities into a much larger single school district. So there's just been this really interesting change in where schools are located and the geographic area that they serve, and we've seen a real change in how that's impacted sense of community. So that's what we're focusing on.
Tammy, I wonder what you're hoping folks will get, the community will get out of your exhibit. I think Bill just had a nice explanation of what he's hoping people in Atlanta and the surrounding areas will see from theirs.
Well, our exhibit, like I said, starts with Kaskaskia, but then we go through the changes in our city's history, from the flour mills and how they've changed over the years, from the coal family that originated here to current production of those kind of things. We focus on the farms as well, and the technology and other aspects like agritourism that's part of farms now is another part of our exhibit. We end with the future, and we like to pose a question about what people can do to impact and enhance their community.
Mm. To Matt's point, Matt, you were mentioning the idea of that this is not just an opportunity for people who are coming to see the exhibit, but also for these institutions, particularly for these libraries. Tammy and Bill, I wanted to follow up with you after. Have there been new skills that you have been able to learn in doing this and putting this exhibition on?
Tammy, you go ahead.
Absolutely. Thanks, Bill. We have. We've learned so much about how to curate an exhibit. There's so much information that we would love to share, but we had to pick and choose the best information, how to put it in a way that people would enjoy seeing it. We've had wonderful partnerships with various individuals and organizations in our community that we hadn't before, so that has definitely been a real plus for us. And now, as Matt mentioned too, we also have some great public programming opportunities. Our Another program we'll be offering on Sunday, actually, is the director of the Illinois State Archives will be here in Chester at 1 o'clock. So if anybody in southern Illinois is listening and they'd like to join us at 1 o'clock on Sunday, he will be talking about Kaskaskia and the road to statehood and how that has changed so much from our state's origins.
So it sounds like lots of opportunities for you, Tammy, and for folks in the area. Bill, what about you guys?
Anytime you put together a new exhibit, and I and others here in Atlanta have been involved with doing exhibits for our museum, anytime you put one together, it's always a new learning experience. This one has been especially interesting because we've done exhibits that primarily just tell a story. Okay, here's the history of this aspect of our community in the past. That's always been our approach. But we've taken a different approach with this one in that we have developed this thesis about the connection between where a school is located and the size of area it serves, and then seeing if that impacts sense of community when that changes. So that's just a new way for us to present an exhibit because, like Tammy, we want people to leave thinking also, well, gosh, do I really think that thesis is true? Does where a school is located and the size of area it serves, does that really have an impact on sense of community? So it's been a real fun experience designing it more as a learning experience than just a straight exhibit.
We've been speaking with Bill Thomas from the Atlanta Public Library and Tammy Graw from Chester Public Library. We're talking about these exhibits that have been organized from Illinois Humanities. Matt Meacham is with us as well from the Illinois Humanities. Matt, as we're thinking about these traveling Crossroads Smithsonian exhibition, we've heard from Chester and from Atlanta. Where else can people look out for this exhibit over the coming year?
In late October up through early December, it will be at the Old School Museum in Winchester, which is in west central Illinois, west of Jacksonville. Then from there, mid-December and remaining up through late January, it will be at the Lake Shelbyville Visitor Center in Shelbyville in sort of southeastern central Illinois. Then it goes to Atlanta in February and March. Then late March through May, it will be at the Marshall Public Library in Marshall in east central Illinois. And then it will conclude at the DeKalb County History Center in Sycamore, mid-May through mid-June.
So it's really getting a tour of the whole state. Tammy, as we think about your exhibit and hearing the excitement from you about what you all have, I wonder if when you're thinking about putting on an exhibit about Kaskaskia, what did you leave out? Is there anything that was really tough that you had to leave out of it that you could share with us?
Oh, boy, that's a bit of a tough question. Probably not so much Kaskaskia as some of the other components that we have. The river is another component of our exhibit. And when you start talking about the Mississippi River, wow, there's a lot of things that we could talk about, from floods to transportation, all the things that have changed because of the river, the river courses, the bridge, lots of things like that. But we tried to touch a little bit on the highlights of that and encourage people to find out more information and to use our library to get that. That would be great.
6 locations throughout Illinois, starting now in our bicentennial year at the Chester Public Library. Chester, as we said, just about an hour south of St. Louis on the Mississippi. I want to thank Tammy Graw with the Chester Public Library, Bill Thomas with the Atlanta Public Library Museum, and Matt Meacham with Illinois Humanities. We will have more details about this all at our website if folks want more information, as it's going to be going around the whole state over the next 6 to 9 months. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, I had a chance to sit down recently with one of the survivors of the genocide in Bosnia in the early 1990s. He lives in Skokie now, and his story is part of a new exhibit at the Illinois Holocaust Museum called Stories of Survival. It focuses on objects that people were either able to take with them or, in Mike Kozovic's case, make while being imprisoned. Please tune in tomorrow to hear Mike's story. As I mentioned, our website is a great place for information for past shows. If you'd like to give us feedback, if you'd like to find our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Thanks to Christine Herman for her production help today as well. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. See you back here tomorrow.